This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the reading of the Wall Street Journal for Monday, May 6th, 2024. I'm Kim Sheridan. Articles read today are primarily from the front page, with additional articles coming from the U.S. News section of the newspaper. Market values from last week are as follows. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 38,675.68, up 436.02, or 1.14%. NASDAQ closed at 16,156.33, up 1.4%. Stocks 600 closed at 505.53, down 0.5%. The 10-year Treasury was up 1 10/32 with a yield of 4.498%. The price of oil was $78.11 a barrel, down $5.74. The value of the euro, $1.0764, and the yen, 153.06. Taking a look at the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, we see a photo prominently displayed, the title of which is Flooding Strikes Brazil and Around the World. In the photo, we see a city street which is flooded. In the foreground, we see people in boats alongside the storefronts. Also, we see in the water, people in the water, and they are in the water up to their shoulders. And in the background, we see crowds of people who are onlooking to the people in the boats. The caption of the photo reads, "Evacuation. People were rescued Sunday in Canoas, Brazil, as armed forces were deployed to the country's southern state of Rio Grande do Sul, struck by flooding. Record temperatures have triggered a surge in rainfall and floods worldwide." The article that corresponds with the photo is entitled, "Record Temperatures Trigger Surge in Rainfall and Floods Worldwide," by Eric Niler. Deadly dam bursts in Kenya and Brazil, a highway sliding down a mountainside in southern China, desert airport runways underwater in Dubai, mining pits flooded in Australia. Large parts of the world are awash. Extreme rainfall and killer floods that have struck around the globe in recent weeks have been unexpected both in their location and power. Combined with infrastructure unprepared for such deluges, the intense rains have caused death, destruction, and mass evacuations. The powerful downpours are the result of natural weather patterns being supercharged by a record-breaking year for global temperatures. As the globe gets hotter, it is getting wetter, too. Simply put, the warmer the air, the more water it can hold. Scientists still don't know whether this year-long record global heat and the downpours that accompany it amounts to a statistical blip or requires a recalibration to a warmer, wetter future that will test national infrastructure, raise insurance premiums, and complicate global food production. In each of the deluges this April, a particular set of severe weather conditions came together to produce the storms, meteorologists and climate scientists said. The amount of rain that fell during these spring storms has been unusual, they say. East African countries, for example, were soaked with 4 to 20 inches of rain during April, up to 6 times the normal amount depending on the area, according to data from the National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center. The intensity of the downpours can cause havoc. Nairobi, Kenya, received nearly 12 inches over a 7-day period, bursting dams, burying towns in mud, and turning city streets into deadly rivers. More than 10 inches fell in a single day in Dubai, submerging its international airport's runways under at least a typical year's worth of rain. Record rainfall totaling 17 inches across the month inundated Guangdong province in southern China, where last Monday a section of a highway collapsed in a mountainous area, killing 48 people. Brazil deployed its armed forces to the country's southern state of Rio Grande do Sul after 6 inches of rain fell in 24 hours, causing mass flooding over the past week that killed at least 75 people, left another 103 missing, and displaced more than 100,000 others. The rainfall-related disasters are the result of warming global temperatures. There have been 10 straight months of record-breaking global average atmospheric temperatures and 12 consecutive months of record global average ocean temperatures. Although questions remain about whether the rise in global temperatures will endure, what is certain is that a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture that later falls as rain, while a warmer ocean evaporates more water to the air, said Sarah Kapnick, chief scientist of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. April's East Africa floods occurred during a rainy season that runs from March to May. This time, the rainfall has been amplified by a weather pattern called the Indian Ocean Dipole. In its positive phase, the dipole pushes warm water against the eastern coast of Africa. In its negative phase, the warm water sloshes back across toward Australia and Indonesia. This year, the dipole is stronger than normal, which is fueling heavy rainfall in areas on the western side of the Indian Ocean, such as Kenya, said Joyce Kimutai, a climate scientist at Imperial College London and member of World Weather Attribution, a group of scientists from universities and research institutes in Europe and the U.S. The warm ocean temperatures plus the evaporative effects of a warmer atmosphere helped set the stage for Kenya's powerful deluge, Kimutai said. At least 50 people were killed last Monday when the old Kijabe Dam overflowed, unleashing a flash flood through the town of Mai-Mahiu. The flooding across the Arabian Peninsula in mid-April that brought Dubai to a standstill was the most severe since record-keeping began 75 years ago. Over April 14th and 15th, Dubai recorded the highest daily rainfall since tracking began in 1949. An analysis of the storm released by the World Weather Attribution Group found the amount of rain was likely influenced by El Niño, a Pacific Ocean weather pattern that leads to warmer ocean temperatures in the eastern Pacific and can affect drought and rainfall patterns across the globe. The Horn of Africa has had several years of drought, while flooding in Kenya has displaced more than 165,000 people, Kenyan and Red Cross authorities said. The back and forth between years of drought followed by periods of extreme and prolonged rainfall makes it difficult for soil and vegetation to absorb rainwater, Imperial's Kimutai said. In the rain-hardened British Isles, the past winter has been one of the wettest on record. Rains left farmers' fields flooded in the middle of the planting season, threatening harvests. Rain damage can be worse in urban areas like Dubai, where water can't soak into the ground, or in rural areas where vegetation has been cut down for food or fuel, said Justin Mankin, associate professor of geography at Dartmouth College. The land surface has a finite amount of water that it can absorb, Mankin said. The built environment shapes how that precipitation gets channeled and presents a hazard to people in the form of flooding. And that's the case in all these areas, whether you're talking about eastern Australia, Dubai, or eastern China. Our next front page article is entitled Group of Kyiv Creditors Plans to Seek a Restart of Payments by Alexander Saidi. Ukraine's lenders said Kyiv could wait to pay them back after Russian troops stormed into the country 2 years ago. Now, their patience is starting to run out. A group of foreign bondholders, including BlackRock and PIMCO, plans to press Ukraine to start paying interest on its debt again as soon as next year, people familiar with the matter said. The group, which holds around a fifth of Ukraine's $20 billion of outstanding Eurobonds, recently formed a committee and hired lawyers at Weil, Gottschall & Mangus and bankers from PJT Partners to negotiate on its behalf. The group wants Kyiv, which is fresh off clinching about $60 billion in U.S. aid, to strike a deal in which it would resume payments in exchange for forgiveness of a big chunk of the country's outstanding debt. Some bondholders in the group have discussed the plans with senior officials in Kyiv. A spokesman for the bondholder group said it looks forward to engaging constructively to assist with Ukraine's sovereign debt. Ukraine is preparing to start talks with the bondholders this month, and Kyiv's advisors are working to get the U.S. and other governments on board. That approval isn't guaranteed. The U.S. and its allies are concerned that taxpayers' money will wind up in bondholders' hands if Ukraine resumes any type of debt service. The countries agreed to give Ukraine a debt holiday on about $4 billion of their own loans until 2027, and have voiced concerns that bondholders could start to be repaid ahead of them. Without a deal, Ukraine could default after the bondholder debt holiday ends in August, tarnishing its reputation with investors and complicating its ability to borrow more. Officials from the International Monetary Fund and some members of the bondholder group met in April in Washington, D.C., where fund representatives indicated total debt relief from the private sector might need to be higher than the bond markets currently indicate. Ukraine's bonds trade at between 25 and 35 cents on the dollar, according to Advantage data, implying losses as high as $15 billion. When the bondholders agreed to a two-year debt holiday in 2022, many thought the war would be over by now. Even though the conflict is dragging on, lenders said they are optimistic that Ukraine's finances are stabilizing. The country has clinched crucially needed aid from the U.S. and Europe and boosted its foreign exchange reserves to a record in April, while Ukraine's central bank is considering a rollback of capital controls this year. The bondholders hope to take in as much as $500 million in annual interest payments after agreeing to debt relief. They have signaled they could be willing to provide further relief later. Some bondholders have suggested that frozen Russian assets in Europe and North America be used to help repay some of what they are owed. The IMF and several Group of Seven countries aren't on board with that idea, but have indicated they could support smaller interest payments between now and 2027, at well below market rates. Ukraine would be reluctant to resume a normal debt repayment schedule before 2027 at the earliest, some of the people said. If a deal is reached, it could be financially rewarding for investors who bought Ukraine's bonds at bargain prices. Next on the front page is this article entitled, "Xi Arrives in Europe as Global Tensions Intensify," by Noemi Biserbe in Paris, Lawrence Norman in Berlin, and Austin Ramsey in Hong Kong. Chinese leader Xi Jinping's first visit to Europe in nearly 5 years is shaping up as a test of the continent's willingness to confront Beijing over its support of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as well as Chinese trade policies that have eviscerated critical European industries. European leaders tend to tread lightly with Beijing, not wanting to jeopardize ties with a major trade partner. But President Emmanuel Macron of France, who is set to meet with Xi on Monday on the first leg of the six-day trip, has cast the Ukraine war and China's trade practices as an existential threat to Europe. Xi arrived in France on Sunday. China has served as an economic lifeline to Russia since the start of the war, providing Moscow with critical support as it seeks to rebuild its military capacity. Beijing hasn't supplied arms to Moscow, but U.S. officials said it has provided satellite imagery to Russia and sold the country microchips, jet fighter parts, machine tools, and other dual-use equipment to bolster its armed forces. Beijing is also a prodigious buyer of Russian fossil fuels. Chinese manufacturers, meanwhile, are flooding Europe with electric vehicles, solar panels, and other goods stemming from a glut and lagging consumption at home. The Chinese economy has been slow to emerge from the pandemic, with falling property prices, high youth unemployment, and deflation stirring fears that the country will seek to export its way out of the slump. Any attempt to stand up to Beijing, however, will require unity among European leaders, and China has a record of playing divide and conquer with capitals across the continent. Macron is trying to show a united front by inviting European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to join him in Paris at the start of his meetings with Xi. Von der Leyen has been a thorn in Beijing's side, accusing China of seeking global hegemony and warning that Europe's relations with Beijing would be shaped by its actions regarding Ukraine. In February, the European Union agreed to impose trade restrictions on three technology and electronics companies from mainland China for the first time since the war started because of what Brussels said is their sale of military usable goods. More may follow, EU officials said. The EU has also used a new anti-subsidy law to launch an investigation into electric vehicle imports from China. Last month, it deployed the same instrument to conduct raids on offices of Chinese security equipment company Nuketech. There are also growing concerns about alleged Chinese spying. Last month, British and German authorities made arrests over alleged Chinese espionage. I think that Europe has a degree of leverage with China. The Chinese economy is weak, said Noah Barkin, a senior advisor with research firm Rhodium's China practice. The Chinese need access to European investment, European technology, but that leverage only works if Europe is united and sending the same message. European divisions have been visible as the EV investigation has proceeded. German auto firms and suppliers remain deeply entrenched in the Chinese market. Any EU tariffs on EV imports from China would risk Beijing's retaliation against the German auto industry. French automakers, which produce lower-priced vehicles more vulnerable to Chinese imports, are cheering on the EU probe. China responded in January to the EV probe by opening an anti-dumping investigation into brandy imported from the EU. That measure is widely seen as targeting France and cognac, its national brandy. European divisions were on full display when Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany went to China last month. He offered no public support to the European Commission's anti-subsidy investigations and remained silent on China's tariffs on brandy. Macron asked Scholz over a recent dinner to join this week's talks with Xi. Scholz declined, citing his plans to travel to the Baltics on Monday. Abigail Vassilier, former deputy head of division for China at the EU Foreign Service Unit, said she expects Macron to take a more confrontational approach to Xi, in part because Beijing sees Paris as the driving force behind the Commission's anti-subsidy drive. French officials said Macron plans to express his concerns to Xi over Chinese companies that might support Russia's war effort. He also hopes to enlist the Chinese leader in resolving the war, the officials said. Macron sees a paradigm shift unfolding in global trade rules as China and the U.S. channel billions of dollars in subsidies toward homegrown industries. In April, Macron delivered a speech warning that the European project of economic cooperation can die if the continent doesn't wake up to the new state of affairs. With many others starting to change the rules of the game and over-subsidizing, from China to the United States of America, Macron said, Europe can't continue imposing strict environmental and economic norms and underinvesting in its industries. Still, Xi will have plenty of opportunities to sow division during his trip. In Belgrade, Serbia, he will mark the 25th anniversary of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization bombing of the Chinese embassy there. The 1999 bombing, which killed three people, badly damaged the Sino-US ties. The U.S. apologized for it, saying it was an accident. Beijing has long used the incident as Exhibit A in its case against U.S.-led security partnerships. Xi plans then travel to Hungary to meet with Prime Minister Viktor Orban, the bête noire of EU politics. Orban has pushed back on EU efforts to aid Ukraine and was the first EU leader to sign a contract as part of China's massive Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative. Also found on the front page is this article entitled, Consumers Fed Up with Food Costs, Ditch Big Brands, by Heather Haddon and Jesse Newman. Consumers are voting with their wallets, and some of the U.S.'s best-known food brands are losing. Coffee drinkers are leaving Starbucks' loyalty program. Chips Ahoy cookies are lingering longer on grocery store shelves. Fewer customers are ordering at fast food drive-thrus and kiosks, pressuring companies such as Wendy's and McDonald's. For about 3 years following the COVID-19 pandemic, food companies pushed through a series of sharp price increases, saying they needed to recoup their own rising costs and that consumers would adjust to stick with their favorite brands. As a result, the portion of U.S. consumers' income spent on food has reached the highest level in 3 decades. Now, some consumers are hitting their limits. Restaurant chains and some food manufacturers are reporting sliding sales or slowing growth that they attribute to consumers' inability or refusal to pay prices that are in some cases one-third higher than during pre-pandemic times. In Laguna Niguel, California, Dennis Montanaro said he recently headed to McDonald's for a favorite order, a bacon and egg bagel with a coffee. The 75-year-old retired manager was stunned to see the $9.67 bill. "I'm done with fast food," Montanaro said. The pace of food inflation in supermarkets and restaurants has slowed significantly over the past year, but prices for goods from burgers to mayonnaise are still far more expensive than they used to be. Fast food prices in March were 33% higher than 2019 levels, according to the Labor Department, while grocery prices were up 26%. U.S. fast food traffic declined 3.5% in the first 3 months of this year compared with the same period in 2023, according to market research firm Revenue Management Solutions. U.S. grocery sales of food and beverages fell 2% by volume for the 52 weeks ended April 20th, compared with the year-ago period, according to Nielsen IQ. McDonald's and other restaurant chains have warned for months that consumers are reining in spending, particularly low-income diners, but the depth of their recent pullback still caught some U.S. restaurant executives by surprise, they said last week. The macro headwinds have been more significant than I think we even anticipated coming into the year, McDonald's chief financial officer Ian Borden said on a recent investor call. McDonald's said its pricing remains competitive in the U.S., including in California, where a higher state minimum wage for fast food workers has contributed to rising prices. At Starbucks, U.S. traffic dropped 7% in the 3 months ended March 31st, the steepest quarterly decline since at least 2010. Starbucks is losing occasional customers, executives said, and its active loyalty rewards users declined by 1.5 million members from the end of the first quarter to the end of the second. David Michael, a 58-year-old attorney from El Dorado Hills, California, said he used to get McDonald's at least weekly, but stopped a few months ago now that some sodas cost $1.69 instead of a dollar, and his regular meal of a small burger, fries, and a Coke has climbed. He said he quit Starbucks after the price for a tall mocha climbed to $5.25. "It's not that I can't afford it now," Michael said. "It's the frustration that the same meal now costs nearly double what it did." Historically, consumers who find restaurants too expensive wind up eating more at home, but some packaged food giants are losing sales too. Kraft Heinz said last Wednesday that its quarterly sales fell 1.2% as higher prices and reduced food stamp benefits in the U.S. weighed on demand. Kellanova, which makes Pringles and Pop-Tarts, said Thursday that North American sales volumes slid 5% after the company increased prices by the same amount. At snack maker Mondelez International, cookie sales are under pressure, especially Chips Ahoy, which the company said are favored by lower-income shoppers. Mondelez has long touted consumers' loyalty to its brands as the company raised its prices, but chief executive Dirk Vandeput said shoppers are now contending with lower food stamp benefits and higher interest rates, along with general inflation. "We have surpassed certain price points, and that is having a big effect," Vandeput said. While Oreos are gaining market share, he said that Chips Ahoy is losing ground to cheaper store brand chocolate chip cookies. The rebellion from consumers is prompting some food companies to shift their strategies, even if offering deals comes at a cost. McDonald's and Starbucks plan to launch more promotions and communicate them more clearly to consumers. Mondelez said it would offer pricing specials and smaller pack sizes, and Kraft Heinz is rolling out new mac and cheese products. Some restaurant chains, such as Domino's Pizza and Cava, have chosen to stand firm on their prices, resisting raising them to try to gain a bigger share of customers, even if it cuts into profit margins. Domino's has kept its national mix and match deal pricing at $6.99 since 2022, helping it to steal share from competitors. Domino's CEO Russell Wiener said, "Customers just don't want surprises," Wiener said in an interview. Vandeput said Mondelez will introduce new, smaller multi-packs for Clif Bar, for example, with 10 energy bars instead of 12 inside, to offer the bars at a lower price. Kellanova CEO Steve Cahalane said the company is offering more deals and adjusting their timing throughout the month, promoting large pack sizes at the beginning of the month when consumers have the most cash on hand, and small ones toward the end of the month. With Pop-Tarts, you may not buy the 20 count, you may buy the 8 count, Cahalane said. Kellanova said its comparable sales rose 5% for the latest quarter and that volume declines in North America continue to moderate. Starbucks, which has long promoted itself as a premium brand, is now trying to emphasize value. The world's largest coffee chain by sales for the first time in July plans to open up deals limited to its app to customers who aren't loyalty members. "These efforts take time, but our team is working with great energy and speed," Starbucks CEO Laxman Narahashian said. Starbucks executives said their customers care about convenience and new products, not just price. Penny Rackley, a life coach and automotive services franchise owner in Texas, said she and her husband have scaled way back on their packaged food purchases in recent years. Rackley, age 58, said she has cut pasta sauce and snack mixes from her shopping cart as prices surged, opting to make homemade versions after routinely discovering that the products were $2 or $3 more than she was expecting. "It's gotten to where you think they've made a mistake," Rackley said. "Over time, you just feel like a boob." This front page article is entitled, "Arizona Booms, Yet Voters Are Glum," by Eliza Collins from Phoenix. By most measures, Arizona has thrived during Joe Biden's presidency. Its semiconductor industry is booming, thanks in part to multi-billion-dollar investment pledges by his administration. Unemployment is near historic lows, and high inflation is finally cooling. The state has become one of the nation's top domestic migration destinations, drawing hundreds of thousands of new inhabitants since 2020. Yet residents here feel surprisingly bad about the trajectory of their state. In a Wall Street Journal survey of swing state voters in March, 60% of residents said Arizona was headed in the wrong direction, nearly twice the share who viewed it as going in the right direction, and the most negative assessment among the seven battleground states expected to decide the presidential race. Half of Arizona respondents said the state's economy had gotten worse over the last 2 years, and nearly three-quarters indicated it's getting more difficult for the average person to get ahead. The findings help explain why former President Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, leads Biden by 5 percentage points among Arizona voters in the Journal survey. "I just haven't seen, since Biden has been in, my life get truly any better," said Earl Riley, 56 years old, a production manager at a semiconductor plant who lives in a Phoenix suburb. "If anything, since Biden has been in, it appears to me things have gotten a little worse." Riley, an independent voter who voted for Biden in 2020 and Trump in 2016, is open to backing the Republican again. 2020 coalition. Biden narrowly won Arizona in 2020 by assembling a coalition of Democrats, independents, and moderate Republicans who now have rejected Trump and his allies in several elections, handing Democrats in 2022 all major statewide offices for the first time since the 1950s. The victories have come even though Republicans and independents outnumber Democrats, who account for only 3 in 10 registered voters. Democrats are hopeful what will keep voters in their column this November is the fight over abortion access. In April, the state Supreme Court revived a 160-year-old ban on nearly all abortions, drawing national attention and throwing state Republicans into turmoil. The state legislature recently repealed the ban, but a legislative quirk means it is still likely to go into effect this summer for several months before returning to the 15-week ban that existed before the chaos began. Democrats already are campaigning on the issue, hoping that an expected ballot measure that would guarantee access to abortion until fetal viability, about 23 weeks, will turn out voters in November who will also support Biden and other Democrats. Biden won Arizona in 2020 by just over 10,000 votes, the tightest vote margin win of any state. This year, though, many voters in his winning coalition are signaling they're unhappy with life during his presidency. They blame a hot local economy for eroding their quality of life. Housing prices in Phoenix have risen by nearly 50% since before the pandemic, according to Realtor.com, and the state has warned that growth is outpacing the water supply. Voters also are frustrated the federal government hasn't solved the immigration crisis at the southern border after illegal crossings set records in recent years. Inflation has eased recently, but residents say staples are still expensive. Arizona is one of the most expensive states to buy gasoline, according to AAA. Arizona has a long history of electing Republicans, and it wasn't a political battleground until recently. Before 2020, voters here had backed only one Democrat for president since 1948, Bill Clinton, and only once. Trish McCreary, age 62, backed Trump in 2016 and Biden in 2020. Now she is undecided about whom to support. The sales consultant from Scottsdale feels there needs to be more border security and a pathway to citizenship for people in the country illegally. She thinks the former president's ability to persuade his party to embrace non-traditional GOP policies makes him better suited to get an immigration measure through Congress, but she is angry that Trump told Republicans to block a bipartisan border bill negotiated by Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, a Democrat turned independent whose seat is open in this year's election. McCreary, a longtime Republican, said she plans to change her party affiliation to independent. She has been turned off by what she views as divisive rhetoric from Trump and the GOP and worries about the criminal counts Trump faces. She said she is likely to back the state ballot measure in November that would expand abortion access. None of that guarantees she'll vote for Biden this November. I could be swayed either way, she said. Left behind. It doesn't appear that the state's surge of new residents favors Democrats. L2, a nonpartisan vendor of voter data, estimates that of the approximately 225,000 registered voters who have come to Arizona since 2018, Republicans accounted for 35%, Independents 33%, and Democrats just under 30%. Many voters said in interviews that they feel left behind by their state's explosive growth. Longtime homeowners are happy to see the value of their home equity skyrocket, but lament that high interest rates and a booming market make it difficult for them to trade up. New homes are popping up farther from city centers, some costing well over $1 million, and traffic has worsened. Arizona has become a top tourism and events destination, hosting the 2023 Super Bowl and this year's NCAA Men's Final Four basketball tournament. Top restaurants book up weeks or even months in advance, and prices for a trendy meal are on par with Los Angeles and New York. The semiconductor industry has flourished with funding from the Bipartisan CHIPS Act passed in 2022, intended to bring production of advanced microchips back to the U.S. and diminish reliance on China. Arizona's semiconductor industry is set to receive tens of billions of dollars in government subsidies and private investments. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing is building a factory complex in Phoenix. Inflation in the Phoenix metro area, after peaking at 13% in August 2022, dropped to 2.2% in February. But many residents are suffering from the 24.2% overall increase in prices over the 2 years ended in February. When you're poor or working class, it doesn't matter what the GDP is or what the economists say, said Representative Ruben Gallego, who is expected to win the Democratic primary for the state's open U.S. Senate seat. What matters is, did your rent go up? Did your rent match wages? Democrats will win, he said, if they talk about making the economy and immigration better for voters and not telling them things are already fixed. Gallego is also running heavily on the issue of abortion access. Gallego is expected to face a highly competitive race against Kari Lake, a former TV anchor and Trump ally who narrowly lost her gubernatorial bid in 2022. Lake said in an interview that independent voters know for a fact the streets aren't as safe as they used to be. Chronic street homelessness is growing. They see the border that's wide open, and no matter what the media and Joe Biden's administration says to try to tell them everything's peachy keen, they know that it's not. Michael Rusconi, age 60, of Phoenix, doesn't know whom he will back in this year's election for president and Senate. As a restaurant owner, he said, he feels the squeeze of inflation and labor costs. He is frustrated there isn't an easier path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who he believes could help solve hiring issues. He said he wants better vetting of those entering the country and for them to be allowed to work legally. All these immigrants are coming across the border, he said. I'm seeing them in the restaurant, and I can't hire them. The abortion issue. Olivia Lewis, age 21, a student in Phoenix, has been unable to move out on her own because of the high cost of rent, which she can't cover with the $15 an hour she earns working part-time at a theater. The Biden administration's support for Israel and its war against Hamas and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, she said, has been frustrating. While she disagrees with a lot of Trump's policies and actions, she appreciates his confidence. Still, the abortion issue is likely to ultimately push her towards supporting Democrats. After the state court reinstated the near-total abortion ban, both Trump and Lake said it went too far. But Lake also said it was unfortunate the state's Democratic leadership has declined to enforce it. Trump has touted his record opposing abortion, including nominating the Supreme Court justices who helped overturn Roe v. Wade, turning the issue over to the states. In the Journal poll, 2/3 of independents in Arizona said they supported access to the procedure, and more voters said they backed Biden's approach than Trump's. Still, the issue was less of a priority for independent voters than the economy and immigration, two issues where Trump has the edge over Biden. The poll was taken in March, before the court ruling. Trump and his allies continue to claim that they won Arizona in 2020, despite no evidence of widespread fraud and a Republican-led audit confirming Biden's win. Lake and other Republicans who ran statewide in 2022 have continued to falsely claim they won their elections as well. Daniel Scarpinato, an Arizona-based Republican strategist who was chief of staff to former Governor Doug Ducey, the last Republican to hold a major statewide office, said Republicans should avoid relitigating the election and figure out a way to clearly state their position on abortion while emphasizing immigration and the economy. These are going to be driving issues, and to win, you just need to be laser-focused on them, he said. David Tapia, age 33, has enthusiastically supported Republicans in the past, including the late Senator John McCain. He doesn't want to have to vote for Biden, but will because he has strong concerns about Trump. He's a sore loser. He can't accept defeat, Tapia said. Tapia said problems with the economy and immigration are being overblown. He is doing better financially than ever as a pest control advisor in the agriculture industry, even though he pays more at the grocery store. Tapia, who lives in Yuma County on the Mexico border, said the surge of immigrants is not as bad as the media portrays it. The Journal poll found nearly 1 in 5 Arizona voters support a third-party candidate, and 1 in 10 were still undecided. Independent voters here are more likely than Democrats or Republicans to choose a third-party candidate, or to say they are undecided, the poll found. The poll found that Arizona's independent voters are equally split between Biden, Trump, and independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who isn't yet on the ballot here, although a super PAC supporting his effort said it had gathered the necessary signatures. Veronica Grace, age 50, a life coach from Sedona, is an independent voter who has consistently voted for Democrats, including Biden in 2020. She said she wasn't thrilled with her choice then, but worried about Trump's indications that he wouldn't accept a loss. This time, she is all in on Kennedy, even if he doesn't make it on the state's ballot. Even if it forfeits my whole vote, because she finally feels inspired by a candidate. Her husband, Todd Wilnant, age 63, a holistic coach, is also backing Kennedy. All I see with people like Biden and Trump and Republicans and Democrats is divisiveness, he said. Another front page article bears the title, Lawyer Lost in Delusion Doesn't See It That Way, by Julie Wernow, from Los Angeles. Rob Dart isn't the successful lawyer and father who left the people who love him 2 years ago to follow his delusions. That Rob lives in the memory of friends and in family photos. This Rob, who arrives on time for our interview, is standing by the roadside under the blazing California sun, his eyes and hair competing in wildness, his grin difficult not to match. In the past year, this Rob has been hospitalized, shot, housed, unhoused, a winner and a loser in court battles. Ultimately, he has shed every scrap of evidence of his life before illness, his connections to his son, family, and most friends. He wanders the streets of Greater Los Angeles, begging for change and lying down to sleep when he is tired. He believes people are controlling him via hypnosis, activated by a headlock. Rob, 44 years old, doesn't believe he is sick. He has refused treatment repeatedly. During a hospitalization last year, he argued remotely before a judge from his hospital bed that he shouldn't be committed. The judge agreed. "I did want to leave the hospital, and I did not want to take the medications," Rob said. Rob's situation isn't that uncommon. Doctors said his behavior is consistent with anosognosia, a neurological condition in patients unaware of their neurological deficit or psychiatric state. More than half of patients with schizophrenia and 40% of patients with bipolar disorder demonstrate anosognosia, or severe lack of insight, studies show. They present a conundrum for society: how to balance individual rights with people's basic health. Solving the nation's mental health crisis requires the participation of some people who don't think they need help. Hundreds of people responded to a Wall Street Journal profile of Rob with stories of their own fights to help people lost in their own delusions. Some of their loved ones found stability after years of chaos, but many family members said they have spent decades living in the grief of losing someone in plain sight. Is it a biochemical disorder? Is it neurodiversity? Is it eccentricity? And who gets to decide? Said Ellen Sachs, a professor of law, psychology, psychiatry, and behavioral sciences at the University of Southern California, who has schizophrenia. "Each person experiences delusions in their own way," Sachs said, "and medication doesn't always erase them. Some people have delusions that last years. Others only experience delusions under severe stress. Psychosis is not like an on-off switch, but a dimmer," Sachs said. Rob draws no distinction between his current and former life. While friends and family said mental illness has taken everything from him, Rob said going off his medications has added context and texture to his experience of life. "You realize you're kind of the same person," he said. "You just know more about yourself." Many states are trying to figure out how to help people like Rob. Nearly every state has laws allowing for court-ordered outpatient treatment. Some states are building hospitals or moving people from encampments to shelters. California is creating courts for mental health to move people who need help off the streets and into treatment. California and Washington are among states that have expanded laws allowing civil commitment for reasons other than violence. States including Colorado and Florida recently gave people with mental illness extra tools to challenge commitments. Civil commitments have risen nationwide, but evidence that commitment helps people recover is lacking. There isn't enough public data to track commitments and draw conclusions about efficacy, said David Cohen, professor of social welfare at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. He said doctors are too quick to force medication to subdue patients. "We try to deactivate people with antipsychotic drugs. We've lost the art of trying to figure out how to tackle this with the person in front of us," Cohen said. Most patients who have been hospitalized involuntarily said they felt they were left out of their own treatment decisions, studies show. When patients participate in decisions about their care, outcomes are better, said Schroeder Stribling, chief executive of Mental Health America, a mental health advocacy network. There aren't enough practitioners to do that painstaking work. The U.S. has a shortage of more than 8,000 psychiatrists, leaving just a quarter of need met, according to KFF, the Health Policy Research Organization. The gap is even wider for people with psychotic disorders, who are treated by specialists in even shorter supply, mental health professionals said. California needs 51 inpatient psychiatric beds per 100,000 adults, a 2021 RAND study found. The state has 15. Patients are often asked to choose between their delusions and taking medications that leave them with tremors, sedation, and sexual dysfunction. Rob said his medications made him gain weight. It made me more afraid. Less assertive, less confident, he said. Who wants to feel like that? He weaned himself off the drugs. Rob slips lightly from cogency to delusion and back again. Over lunch at a diner, Rob talked about books and movies, about the pandemic and working from home, and how inconsistent Starbucks employees are about free water and bathroom access. He's funny. He asked enough probing questions to nearly derail the interview. After nearly 2 hours, Rob looked up with a flash of self-consciousness. Has the interview gone on too long? He asked. When he talked about the people working to destroy him, his grin vanished. He said he wants to get back to being a lawyer and believes people have taken his intellectual property. He has refused to see his mother and sister. He believes they are among the people colluding to erase his memories. But he said he sometimes thinks about reconnecting with loved ones. I'm not sure exactly how, he said. Some professors enter the fray, aiding and joining protesters, by Douglas Belkin and Melissa Korn. More university professors are joining the demonstrations roiling college campuses, both to voice support for Gazans and to defend their students' right to protest. Faculty, many of whom are in their 60s and 70s and came of age during the era of Vietnam War protests, are pushing back against university presidents, accusing the leaders of heavy-handed and inconsistent crackdowns on free speech, and warning against a wave of authoritarianism some say has been creeping onto campuses for years. Professors in leadership positions are guiding calls for votes of no confidence, spearheading classroom walkouts and visiting encampments alongside students. Many are facing punishment from police and their employers. In recent days, police have arrested professors during demonstrations at schools, including Washington University in St. Louis, Emory University, and the University of California, Los Angeles. Over the weekend, police disbanded encampments at the University of Virginia, University of Southern California, and Art Institute of Chicago, while protesters at Vassar College in New York voluntarily ended their encampment after reaching a deal with administrators. The commencement ceremonies of University of Michigan and Indiana University were marked by student protests, but they were largely able to proceed as planned. At Indiana, more than 3,000 faculty, graduate workers, students, staff, and alumni have called for the resignation of President Pamela Whitten, saying she escalated confrontations between demonstrators and police by changing the rules of engagement for protesters at an encampment without adequately informing the campus. In a statement, Whitten emphasized the school's commitment to free speech and defended her actions, saying, "Anti-Semitic episodes have been linked to this national encampment campaign and have become magnets for those making threats of violence." At the University of Texas at Austin, more than 700 faculty signed a letter pushing for the school's president, Jay Hartzell, to resign. The letter says he needlessly put students, staff, and faculty in danger by calling in law enforcement to campus. Pauline Turner Strong, a professor of anthropology and women's and gender studies at UT Austin, said the show of force by police at a recent demonstration she attended was greater than other times since she started teaching there in 1993. except when there was an active shooter on campus. In that case, we really felt like we were being protected from an active threat, she said. In this case, it feels like the police are the actual violent threat. A representative for UT said a host of weapons had been confiscated from protesters and that both staff and police officers have been physically assaulted and threatened. We will continue to safeguard the free speech and assembly rights of everyone on our campus while we protect our university and students who are preparing for their final exams, the representative said. Faculty have a long history of criticizing their institutions and, in some cases, supporting student movements like free speech in the 1960s and divestment from South Africa in the 1980s, said Robert Cohen, a professor of social studies and history at New York University, who studies social protests and student movements. In the current wave of campus unrest, he said, faculties have gone far beyond the types of advocacy they typically push. Recommending a policy change via a university senate resolution or stopping by to express solidarity with students at a protest event. It's really unusual for faculty to be willing to engage in disobedience and risk arrest, Cohen said. Faculty are partly voicing concern that administrators are ignoring standards of shared governance, a unique system in higher education that gives employees a greater voice than they generally have in the corporate world. Faculty are often awarded oversight of academic affairs and have at least some say in student discipline and other university issues. UT Austin's Strong said the administration's move to quell protests is part of a drift toward more top-down decision-making and authoritarian governance, which she attributes to cuts in public funding and a greater reliance on private donors. Some faculty across the country are counter-demonstrating against Hamas and in support of Israel, but at many schools, professors have overwhelmingly supported the pro-Palestinian students. From the U.S. Watch column, in Texas, more storms hit the Houston region. More storms moved on Sunday through the saturated Houston area, where flooding from heavy rains has led to the rescue of hundreds of people from homes, rooftops, and roads. It's going to be raining through the day, said National Weather Service meteorologist Haley Adams. Over the past week, areas near Lake Livingston, northeast of Houston, have gotten more than 20 inches of rain, she said. And this will conclude the reading of the Wall Street Journal for today, Monday, May 6th, 2024. I'm Kim Sheridan, wishing you all the best.